Data Practices Subcommittee will come to order. We do have a quorum, so I see that Representative Horton needs approval of the minutes of our last meeting, which was February 5th, 2013. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion fails. Minutes are approved. Folks, here's what we're going to do. We are going to meet today. We're going to meet Friday. It is my hope, although I can't make a prediction, that we will sort of tie things up on Friday. The other thing we're going to do is we're going to operate under the Phyllis Kahn School of Legislating, which is to have things alive in as many places as possible. So we are going to do an omnibus bill, but we're also going to pass these bills out on their own. You just never know how this is going to go. So we're going to do both just to give authors maximum flexibility. And the reason for that is some of these bills have other stops and they have to make deadline. And if we wait even a couple of days and make the entire omnibus bill move along where its constituent parts have to go, I think that could be confusing to folks. So we're going to do both. We're probably not going to mark up the omnibus bill today. Under the vehicle bill for that will be the item 7 on the agenda, which is my bill, House File 695, which is my thinking, utterly non-controversial, as I think you'll agree. So that'll be the vehicle bill, and we'll just end up, frankly, on the ones that we pass out of here as individual bills. The plan is to cut and paste them and add them as amendments onto that bill. So we're going to do both. So these bills will be passed out of here. They will leave our committee, not being laid over, so that they can go to other stops that they need to go. So we only have now less than an hour and a half tonight, and so I really will ask folks to be short with their testimony. We do have at least one bill that I think can fairly be called controversial. So this is, in my opinion, at least not one of them. So we're going to leap up the Representative Hillstrom for House File 501. So I will move that. Representative Holder, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say you're going to put some of these bills out of here, do they have to be moved back through civil? When you say move them out of here, would you further define that for us?
Yes, I sure have. They do have to go back to civil law. So Chair Lesh, it will be up to him to do what he wants to do with them. So my motion then would be I move that House File 501 be recommended passed and we refer to the Civil Law Committee. That's the motion. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, this bill was brought to me through the Anoka County Attorney's Office, and with me today I have testifiers from the Anoka County Medical Examiner's Office. Members, this is about getting data when they're attempting to identify a deceased. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just turn it over to Dr. Ann Tracy, and she can briefly talk about the issue.
Dr. Tracy, just identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
I'm Dr. Ann Tracy. I work at the Midwest Medical Examiner's Office. We are the appointed medical examiner for 12 counties in Minnesota. We also do referral cases for about 14 other counties in Minnesota and Wisconsin. We also have approximately 500 examinations in 2012. What we're asking for is expansion of the provisions of 171.07 to allow the medical examiners to have access to driver's license photographs or identification card photographs. Why we want this is just basically to help fulfill our duty as medical examiners by statute 390.25 that we make reasonable attempts to promptly identify deceased individuals. For some individuals, a driver's license photograph or identification card photograph may be the only known photograph that we have. And we're just asking for this so that we can promptly identify them, to notify their family members, to get them released to the funeral home so their family members can make arrangements. I think that's just making it very quick. That's the we're very aware with some of the incidences lately of individuals accessing driver's license photos inappropriately. We do annual training with data privacy, public records requests dealing with those issues. All medical examiners and coroners in the state of Minnesota by statutes are licensed physicians. We are very well aware of dealing with private medical records, private data, and we treat the data as private.
Mr. Chair, I also have an investigator.
Just identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Catherine Kamen, investigator for Midwest Medical Examiner's Office. As an office investigator, normally we're functioning to track down this information, DVS photos and DVS information, by going through law enforcement agencies, which takes quite a bit of time and can be frustrating for our office, law enforcement, as well as families waiting for this identification. I'd also like to point out that we have already been granted access to DVS information, including records, demographic information, physical description. The only thing that we are lacking access to is the photograph, and that's often the most important piece of information we need.
That's it.
Okay. Any questions, comments, concerns from members? Is there anyone from the public who wishes to be heard on this bill? Okay, seeing no one, I'll move my motion that House File 501 be given and passed and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you.
The next bill is House File 20. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just by way of background, this bill was introduced early and heard early by the Civil Law Committee, as I understand it, before this subcommittee was actually created. So this bill has already been explained to members of the subcommittee, and there were testifiers in support of it as well, but in deference to the subcommittee members' time, I'll skip over that just briefly summarize it. And one thing I want to mention too, because it was heard in that committee, there was a legal amendment that I had offered that was accepted by the committee, but since it was just laid over, there wasn't a committee engrossment. So I believe you may have a version of the bill as it was introduced, but there's an amendment quoted DE1, which the Civil Law Committee already already approved, so that is the version I'm working off of. This is the bill that, I was on the City Council in Golden Valley for 9 years. We have a lot of email lists when I was there. People would sign up to receive notifications about snow emergencies and public safety meetings, things like that. All those email lists are kept by the city and are considered public data. There was a story on NPR about 6 months ago that I noticed, I think there's a copy of that also in your packets, where a political candidate was requesting email addresses from the people in the district she was running in, presumably to send out political mail, political spam type email, and I was just surprised by that. I don't think people sign up for snow emergency notifications with the expectation that the city is going to be required to divulge the information. So the bill, as it's amended here, would make that data private. I subsequently learned after working on this bill that the League of Minnesota Cities is also interested, as well as a few other organizations of that nature. So I've been working with them too, but the impetus for this bill for me was just hearing about it on that NPR story. So, and Patrick Hines from the League is here available to testify or answer questions.
Okay. Representative Freiberg, before we go on, I forgot to move your bill. So I will move that House File 20 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Laws. So now we have the bill before us formally.
Is that not before we get House File 20 as amended, right, or anything like that?
Well, no, because I don't think so, and maybe Ms. Antonia or Mr. Buren can advise. I know that we're working off of what says at the top of it, DE1, because we don't have the latest engrossment. So we haven't added an amendment here at this committee, so I'll treat what we have before us as the DE1 as the current engrossment. Is that right, Mr. Buren? Okay, maybe Mr. Guerin's saying that maybe a cleaner approach is to move the DE1 amendment, and then the committee can adopt it. So,
Mr. Chair, I believe that is already laid over in civil law, so it wouldn't be. It's already there. The bill.
Well, that's an interesting question about whether we have it in our possession. Was it laid over, or was it referred to us? Okay, that's a fair solution. Ms. Anton has recommended that since it's not completely clear, it's a fair point, it was laid over probably with the intention that we take it up. The question is whether or not we when we had it in our possession, was there a formal referral or just the idea that we would talk about it? So why don't we, this is an unusual legislative creature here. I suppose we could take a vote that would recommend something, I suppose. This is an interesting one. I can say in 9 sessions, I don't think I've seen this.
We can make a motion to dissolve the RS-37 ordinance.
Well, I think the easiest thing to do, since it's not clear that we formally have it in our possession, I think the easiest thing to do would be to take testimony, assume just for a moment, without conceding, that it resides in the civil law committee currently, and technically that means whatever amendments we would want to put on, we would do there, but we'll take testimony here to that effect, or about the bill generally. I think that's probably the safest thing to do. The last thing we want to do is play around with the bill and make additions of any kind, only to find out that we never had it in the first place. So,
Mr. Chair, did we already add in civil law, then we already add this amendment, so it's already been as amended? I mean, okay.
Yes, Representative Scott, my understanding is that what we're looking at, the document that says we have a right, H0020DE1, is the formal and official state of the bill as it resides in the civil law committee. So this is the bill. We just don't know how formal and gross, but this is the bill right now. So will you finish with your kind of opening remarks, what was in front of you? Okay. Any comments or questions for Representative Freiberg from members of the committee?
I have a question. Remind me again on item number 3 on 1.11 on the DE1. Why the city or any local unit of government would need someone's internet username, password, and protocol? I mean, I understand the address, but why would a unit of government need an internet username or password of an individual?
Mr. Hines might be able to speak more clearly to this, but I can speak to my experience in Golden Valley. There's, you know, Golden Valley, I think you create an account with the city where you submit your email address and you check a box about everything you want information on, whether it's no emergency routes or public safety notices or notifications that the city council agenda packet is ready, as a planning commission agenda packet is ready, and periodically you can go back in and change your preferences. So you create an account name and then a password for it as well. I think it's similar kind of in the legislature. We have it with the My Bills program. Like, I had to create an account for that too, and I use what's normally my password. So I think the city of Minneapolis recommended this. At least in my mind, it makes sense, just because, you know, the password I used for My Bills is the same as the password I use for a lot of things, and I wouldn't want anyone to be able to know that. So,
thank you.
Mr. Hines, do you need that? You need not. Okay. Any other questions from members for the author? Okay. Seeing none, then I will open it up to public testimony. Is there anyone here who wishes to be heard on this bill? Okay. Mr. Gimberlin, please just introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Don Gimberling. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I think we said a few things at the full committee, but I just want to add to those remarks and probably re-emphasize them, and I'll try and be brief. One of the things that I used to specialize in when I worked for the government with this kind of legislation is look out for unintended consequences, because this stuff tends to be complex, and the complexity is not just the law, it's also how it gets applied to the real world and how the government does its business. So a couple of unintended consequences that I see here. What you're doing with the bill is you're cutting off public access to information about citizens who are interested in the government. The language on their email addresses that are received for notification or informational purposes, that's what's being classified. Conceivably, what you do then is you affect the power balance between citizens and the government. You give the government the opportunity to have lists of citizens, and they can communicate with those citizens on any issue or policy before a government entity, and citizens will have no way to respond to that except to organize separately, because they won't have access to the same list.
Okay? And, you know, I understand the dilemma, but I'm not quite sure you want to do that. Okay?
The second possible unintended consequence is you really do stop people from organizing to participate in the government.
Let me give you an example.
I go to the city, we'll pick on cities, and I say, I'm really concerned that I heard that you were going to put a rendering plant in my neighborhood. Okay? And then later on, somebody from another part of the city that's more downwind comes and says, you know, I'm really worried about this rendering plant. Is anybody else worried about that? Has anybody contacted you about that? And the answer is, well, yeah, somebody's contacted us, but we can't tell you who it was. Okay? Two possible unintended consequences. The second thing I want to say is the language that's, let's see, I got to get the right language on the email. The language on 1.5 and 1.6, which says, notwithstanding Section 1304, Subdivision 2, excludes the collection of this data from everybody's most vulnerable part of the Data Practices Act, the tenants of warning. Okay? Now, there was testimony in the full committee that providing this address was voluntary and therefore no tenants of warning was required. There was further testimony that there had been a consultation with IPAD, and IPAD had said no tenants of warning was required. I found that to be very odd, so I talked to IPAD, and the IPAD representative told me that they had not given that kind of advice. Okay? Now, why do we care? Well, if I have to give the government my address, and in situations, I have to give it to them. If I want to sign up for a snowplow notification, they're going to tell me, if you want to do that, you have to give me your email address. That's not voluntary. Now, the sign-up is voluntary, but providing my email address is not voluntary. And that's when the tenants of warning kicks in. Because the statutory setup for the tenants of warning is an individual asked to supply private data shall be informed of, and then the rest of it is what is actually the tenants of warning. So, another example based on what's now in the DE amendment. And if somebody raises the question, Representative Scott, why does the government need my password? Okay? Well, can the government, because they haven't told me what they can do with my password, and I have no idea what they can do with my password, then able to do anything they want with my password? Keep in mind, the rationale behind the tenants of warning has always been, this is how we as individuals protect ourselves from invasions of privacy by the government. Okay? Because the tenants of warning gives us the information on which we can make an informed decision as to whether or not we want to provide data to the government. And if you remove that requirement in a situation like this, you remove my informed choice about providing this data. Okay? What you're saying is, the government can say to me, if you want this service, you have to give us this data. And that's it, okay? I don't get the service if I don't get the data. So those are the problems we see with this, unintended consequences, and I'm not real sure you want to excuse government from collecting private data and not having to give tenants warnings. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Gamberling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. In a situation where a citizen signs up for a snow plow or a snow emergency alert by email, they're asking to be notified by email. So it would be nonsensical for them to not consent for the governmental entity to have their email address if they're asking to be notified by email. So I guess I'm...
Mr. Chairman, I understand your dilemma, but what you've always done with these things is you don't look at the detail of the transaction. For example, I'll give you the best example I'm coming up with is I have to fill out personal information on my income tax form.
I don't have any choice. If I don't file an income tax form, I'm gonna go to jail, okay? But you still require the government to tell me what it's gonna do with that information, okay? So if I really am a tax resister, and there are people out there who are, I can make an informed choice as to whether or not I'm gonna suffer that consequence. And so even in the situation in which I'm asking the government to do something for me, I really ought to know whether or not I want to do that based on the privacy implications. What's going to happen with the data? And I may very well choose, even though I'd like to have this service, now that I know what the privacy implications are, I may decide not to take the service. Okay.
Thanks, Scott.
So what, in a case where, you know, I'm no data practices guru, I've ended up on this committee in servitude. But in a situation where the government is not disclosing the data, so in this case, where what we're trying to do in this bill is to protect the information so that nobody can come along and get it.
Right.
Do we need to give a Tennyson warning in that case where it's not going to be disclosed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Portman, that kind of is the problem. From the individual perspective, I don't know if the government's going to disclose this information. You've made it private. You're making it private. But that doesn't mean the government can't do anything with it. It just prevents disclosure of the information to the public. So, for example, if the government wants to use it to say to citizens, we really want you to support this bond issuance, and here's all of the reasons why, the government conceivably can do that. Keep in mind, under the Data Practices Act, local units of government have been given the authority by the legislature to decide what they can and can't do with private or confidential data. You've given them that authority. So if somebody out there wants to pass an ordinance saying we're going to use these to advance objectives of the city, they can do that unless you've said otherwise that they cannot.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Representative.
If I make to that point, even if the data is classified as private, we still would have disclosure to law enforcement. So you might say that there is no disclosure with the voluntary. You know, they're not going to use it. There are instances where, beyond the city's control, somebody will have access to that information.
That's true. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Anyone else from the public who wishes to be heard? Mr. Meister, just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. It's like deja vu. About 6-7 years ago, Representative Larson, these same issues came up. And it was debated in the committee. And one of the reasons why it did not go the way to make email information private as is being proposed now is because at that time, school districts and some cities were sending out through the email addresses that they had things in their newsletters or being in support of certain kinds of things. I brought up, speaking with Representative Larson and other people at that committee, a couple of those situations, testimony in general and privately, the bill will go forward. That's one of the principles that Mr. Gimberling has indicated to you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, that when the school districts or other folks, and this is happening to some extent, push out material, other people should be able to have that same, if it's a different point of view. Now, secondly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if you would look at the amendment, one thing that gives me heartburn, and it goes to the thing of unintended consequences and how government likes to manipulate folks and citizens in my years of involvement, is the words on 1.7, or other informational purposes. Now, if you take a look out of the years and years and years of the email address issue, which we have a lot, this is the first time it's come. Addresses, regular addresses, if I wanted to get the list of all the people, you know, if they're still doing newsletters, can get that. You know, all the signs, we're just focusing on emails. But the issue about communication with citizens being able to do things, I think, is important. Now, what does other informational purposes mean? There was almost an hour discussion about that in the other body, and the bill at this point is laid over. For a number of reasons, that was a factor. There are other factors too. But when other informational purposes, let's say, for example, I ask for information with the Director of Public Works about some issues that are happening on my street. And you also have to remember, under a certain age, me, Mr. Chairman, being an old man, and catching up to the computer these days, I'm very much aware of how people are using the email address as their identification. They may not say their name, but it's a way of contacting. So let's say the Director of Public Works is given a message asking specifically, not only serve, hey, can you tell me what's happening on the corner of my street here in New York? I think I have some issues here. But maybe someone else down the street might even have the same issue. And someone who is very much involved in listening communities sometimes like to see if there are other folks who might have those same concerns. So you go to the Director of Public Works, hey, have you had similar kinds of questions? Oh, yes. These are the comments, and these are the people who contacted us, at least through email. So then maybe I might want to send them an email. Hey, my name is Rich Neumeister, and there's some many issues here. Other informational purposes is not being defined. Speaking with Mr. Gunderson, in the other body, and folks, I didn't get a straight answer. That's where the mischief can be played, by information that has been very much considered for decades to play around with that. Secondly, Mr. Chairman, one of the great things about getting on the net these days and getting a lot more information than I used to, found out on the net that the city, Minneapolis Parks Department, 69 pages worth, thought, my impression by speaking to people, that when comments were made to the public in the public record on issues, they were deleting their email addresses. So what happens when Johnny Jones, Jimmy Jones, Rich Neumeister, or whoever wants to see, I'm interested to contact people about these elements of public record, where you get very strong discussion, robust discussion in a community, which is free speech is all about, and what's the essence of our democracy. That may not happen. What happened in the situation was told to the Parks Board in the city of Minneapolis, you shouldn't be doing this, the law hasn't been passed yet. And we redacted the redaction. So, Mr. Chairman, if the bill is going to go, you know, it depends on where it goes and where you're at with it, at least I would encourage that other informational purposes be stricken from the bill. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's my two cents. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Neumeister. Ex officio member Resch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Neumeister, you brought this up as well as Mr. Gamerlain. Why, if you're distrustful of the government, would you trust the government to give you an accurate list of the people who complained about a particular problem?
Because, Mr. Chairman, I can only say from my experience, Mr. Chairman, because I've gotten it. And if I know that I haven't, I'll ask for them again. And by the time, if you're right, you know, in my situation, second or third time, I get what I am asking for. Sometimes government likes to be a barrier to information, but I can just tell you that I've been able to get the information in situations, like an email to the Director of Public Works talking about problems in my neighborhood. Or let's say someone in the community has some questions about how law enforcement is and complaining in general about police protection or whatever. That's always been public.
Well, Mr. Chair, I understand that you wouldn't want that proviso on the off chance that you got a straight up honest public servant who just wants to do their job and follow to the T. But if we're talking about keeping the government accountable, it strikes me that in the history of the Republic, we've not relied on government to do that. We relied on the press to do that and individuals who organize around them. And if you're going to organize, you wouldn't rely on the government to be a factor in your organizing, because you're organizing vis-a-vis the government.
I'm Representative Resch. what's happened in our society, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lesh, is that the government now has a lot of information. And one of the things, because they are so centralized in our lives these days, that's where people go to make their points. And sometimes that's a reservoir where you can at least get points of view, or at least similar kinds of view, to at least you can get access to at least email, you know, their contact information. To me, there's apples and oranges here, Mr. Chairman, and Chairman Lesh. There's a difference between the listservs. There's a difference between someone who, and which you see a lot now these days, sending a comment or two to people and using the email address as their identifying piece of information, maybe not put anything else. And if you have something similar, or the same view, or whatever, or even a different point of view, I see what the public is not going to fall. This city is not going to fall on the wrong run in regards to ability, but I think it loses something. If you let the government be able to use that little piece that I was talking about, other information purposes without it defined, I think we'll lose something. Lose the ability, accountability, transparency, and community discussion. And I don't see, I can see some aspects of why you want to do the listservs, but to where you put it into a black hole and leave it to 300 cities to interpret what other information purposes is. That precedent. And that's just Mr. Chairman and Mr. Lesh speaking from 35 years of working at closest level of government, and that's been me. I go back up in 1916. This is a bad policy to have other information purposes in there in today's society.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Lesh, just in your committee yesterday, you made comment about a testifier that would provide their accurate name in order to keep their anonymity. If you have communication sets with government in which there is no name associated with it, and under other informational purposes, and there's only an email address and nobody can get that information, you stifle the public square or the ability, the community organization, or the checks and balance. Have there been other people that have been concerned about the behavior of the park supervisor at the preschool program? To the degree that you limit information accessibility of people to check on the workings of the government, I think that's dangerous. And so the notification thing is one. But we have bill after bill after bill being introduced this year that makes information private, that limits the ability of the public to double check on government. And I get it, it's attention. I mean, I'm a privacy freak. I don't like my stuff being out there. But on the other hand, if only the government entities have access to this information and nobody else does, how do you ever have any checks and balance in what they're doing?
Representative Holbrook, the only time the government is the one that provides the public square for those voices is when we are considering policy or due process, right? So in a courtroom, and considering policy in front of the committee. That's why I insisted on having the record clear on who was talking, because subsequent appellate decisions and the record has to be clear about who's saying what. But when you're organizing, and you're organizing against the government, I guess, in my opinion, you shouldn't be relying on the government to give you the information around which you organize. That's not democracy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, let me give you an example. If a controversial development is coming into town and you go to the planning commission meeting and you find out that there's 50 other people there that are mad as hell they're going to put a 10-story apartment building a block from your homes, under current way of doing things, you can get those people that showed up in the meeting and signed up or sent a letter with their concerns, you can get their contact information to maybe have a follow-up meeting before the city council meeting, prepare to organize as a group, to quote-unquote, talked about this before, fight City Hall. If we are limiting access to data sets in which it's the only way to contact an individual, then that ability to interact with our fellow citizens is gone.
I just want to make sure I understand your argument, because it's an interesting argument, but as I read this on line 1.7, that citizen wouldn't be foreclosed from getting those other 50 names. I mean, if people sign up at a meeting of the kind that you described, I don't know if that would be information that the city had gathered for notification or informational purposes. Now, maybe you're saying that informational is so vague that you don't know one way or another, but I don't know if I'd automatically conclude that. I see what you're saying. You'd want to get together with those other 50 people and be able to get those names. I don't know. Maybe that's something the operator can talk about.
What's in the rest of you ever?
It's just basic philosophical difference. That's not the only way you get their information, Rep. Sokolba, because the other people showed up at that meeting. And if it was me, that's how I would be going around collecting those names and information by which I could communicate with them. I would certainly not wait until the government had collected their names and then ask the government for a list and then hope the list was accurate because I was organizing against the government. It's just not my idea of how you organize.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can put it in another context. There's a list, you understand, have a home near Como Lake, you're really happy with it, and you're gonna apply for a conditional use permit because you want to put a storage shed up, okay? And somebody makes contact with the government, doesn't provide their name or address in an email, but sends an email and says, that Mr. Lesh is totally crazy, this building is not going to conform. It's full of all kinds of, from your perspective, misinformation, and you'd like to contact that person to help understand their concerns, set the record straight or whatever, and the city says, well, we don't have a name, all we have is this email, and the email is private, and so there is no way you have or even knowing you're contacting this person that has expressed all these concerns.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand that. If you're talking about a legal process, I always have the right to face my accuser, always, under the Constitution. Now, in the context of what flagged it was an individual's email, and then the licensing department took that on as their cause du jour, and they agreed with that, well, they would have to independently prove those facts, like I'm crazy and off my rocker, and there's all kinds of problems with it. And if that were the case, then the government themselves would be the ones causing my problems. And it is frustrating when that happens, because I'd like to know who raised the red flag, but I don't think if the government agreed with it, I'd have my challenge against the government, not against the person.
I just want to point out, we have 50 minutes, we will run out of time, and we don't formally have this bill before us. So this is really just a discussion. We have other bills that are before us. It's a good discussion, a useful discussion, but I would suggest that after not too much longer, we suspend the discussion. We can pick that discussion up again on Friday, or maybe in the Civil Law Committee. But I wanted to get to the author who wanted to chime in, Representative Freiberg.
Sure. I was just going to say, the situation that's been described is not, it's not really a notification or informational purpose in my mind. It's not a mass communication. So I don't know that it would qualify. And also, in time, I should mention the content of all of these emails. That's one thing that hasn't been said. The content it's still public. It's just the specific modes of communication here, the telephone number, the email address, and the internet username and password.
Resident Freiberg, I would just urge you, before the next time we discuss this, which may be in a full committee, you might want to give some thought to the informational purposes. One idea might be informational purposes as requested by the citizens. So if they sign up for, I want to know if snow emergencies, and I want to know the, you know, if there's a rendering plans, and I want to know all that, then for those purposes, maybe you want to tighten that. That would be something to think about. I know we have one other testifier who was asked to be on the list, I believe. Oh, there's two. Okay. Sir? If you state your name for the record and proceed.
Good late afternoon. I'm Bob Zick, Z-I-C-K, and I've talked with Mr. Fry on this issue. I'm a reporter for Inside NewsHour, public cable television. And we've been out there showing citizens what government is doing to them for 28 years. And this, in the most simplest basic terms, this is bad legislation. And I say that because the Minnesota Data Practice Act, there's a presumption under that act. The first presumption is that all data collected by government is presumed to be public. The Supreme Court says, we encourage speech, we don't limit speech. So we don't give something to the government for their use that the citizens don't have access to. And what I see here is governments down here protecting their monopoly. It's not the citizens complaining. I can give as many free email addresses as I want. I can give one to the government and I can have one for that I protect dearly. But once I give it to government, it's government's data. And everybody should have access to that. Unless there are extraordinary circumstances, this information should remain public. Now, the fact that the bar should be high, this sets a low bar. And the fact that people find this offensive, that's not the standard. If you want to talk about offensive public information, how about the salaries of public employees? How about the divorce court records? How about voting records? Those are all public. This is an email address. Can these totally give me? That's me. Email addresses are something that you can have private if you don't want to give them out. But because they're free, if you're going to give something to government, give them one that when you receive information, if you don't want it, like junk mail that comes to your house, you throw it away. You delete it. You don't have to open it. And nobody knows who the email address belongs to unless you absolutely include a name and address in there. So to that end, this is bad legislation. Like I say, this protects government. It doesn't protect the people. I would ask the author, what harm are they trying to correct? What harm? Now, I want to set the record straight here. A few weeks ago, over in the judiciary on the Senate side, there was a hearing. And the assistant city manager from Maplewood testified over there. And he testified without a vote of the Maplewood City Council. But he said that, and I attribute this to me, that I received 6,000 email addresses. In fact, I received less than 2,000 email addresses. Those email addresses had many, numerous mistakes in them. They gave them to us in a JPEG form, not in a spreadsheet like the city has them for their use. We had to go through and retype out every email address, with a lot of them being unusable. So if you want to have a bill, a good piece of legislation, have a bill that says this information
is there for the public, and the government can't distort it when they give it to the public. So, again, why aren't people down here complaining? Why is it government? Why is it government down here protecting their monopoly? A phone book has my telephone number in it. Why don't I object to that? My gosh, somebody can go get a phone book and look up my name and address, and they can actually come to my house. An email address, you can't go to somebody's house. There's that total wall there. Somebody sends you an email mail, don't open it if you don't like it. What is government concerned about? Why does government want to protect their monopoly on this? Bankruptcy courts. When a company goes bankrupt, regardless of what they told you, when they collected your email address, that's an asset. And the bankruptcy courts will sell that, allow that asset to be sold regardless. So email addresses are out there. When we got them, we used them. We knew we had to worry about spam. You can't send out 2,000 email messages in one shot. That doesn't work. There's spam that filters that. We got those informations. We wanted to inform people about fire station closings and about government taking over private trash hauling. Citizens need to have the right to this information. When there's a list, and I come into a public meeting, and there's a sign-up list there, that list belongs to the government. I have to ask them to get a copy of that. I'm not entitled to take that and make a copy of it. Make the bill say that when we get the information, it's accurate information, and it gets shared. That it isn't something that the school district used, and we've documented this, where they've used it to promote levy increases, building projects. And so when the last speaker talks about what kind of information, anything can be disguised as information.
Mr. Zook, you got a fair chance.
Okay. Thanks.
We've got a lot of bills, a lot of testifiers, a lot of passion, and this is just a discussion. We have one more person who's going to testify, and then we're going to end the discussion, because that's all it is a discussion. We've got bills to move. Thank you, ma'am. If you could please be brief,
yes. And
please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. I'm Diana Laundrie. I live at 1771 Burr Street in Maplewood, and I have my law office also in Maplewood. Today, I'm testifying as a citizen that supports transparency, accountability, and an equal playing field for all. Now, my email address is laundrie@hotmail.com. Now, before I had this email, somebody in France had it, but they lost it because they didn't continue to use it. So now I have it. But I also have other emails, such as mayorlaundrie@yahoo.com, teldye@gmail.com, teldye@yahoo.com. Now, why do I share this with you? Well, I share this with you because when you look at those emails, other than the fact that I have a unique last name, the other emails, what can you tell from those emails about me? Not much. Now, I want to talk a little bit about this idea about what's confidential data and what's private data. With confidential data, I think it's generally accepted that confidential data is on an individual that is non-anonymous. That if you were to be an outside party, you could identify that data with that individual in some particular manner, such as a social security number. Now, the question is an email confidential data? If you can't identify anything about that person from it, I doubt that it's confidential. Is it private data? Well, it's an address. Let's think about the definition of an address. In the brick and mortar world of real estate, you have a street address. So when you want to send them a letter, you send it to their brick and mortar address, correct? But let's say that they have the new wave, which is to have an email address. That is their address, their location in the e-cloud, so to speak. That is only a location. It is an address of where you can find someone to communicate with them. So I don't think it's private. Now, with regard to Minnesota's Chapter 13, it's a model sunshine law that has been certainly very much admired and has been approved and is for those who champion transparency in government, it's one of the most effective and successful tools that they can utilize in keeping government responsive and accountable. Now, I think it's important to note that I get this feeling that some folks would like to pass H.R. 20 because they're concerned that email data will be used to communicate a message that is not agreed with. However, there's the flip side to that coin. What if the government is undertaking efforts, anti-union efforts, such as those in Wisconsin, and that our unions want to alert citizens beyond just their members about this huge public policy issue? How can they find and contact those people through email? This is one way they can do it. They're using the email data that's available to them to communicate to people outside of their membership. What if there's a local veterans nonprofit that's reaching out to the community to inform of services to assist in returning veterans?
Ms. Longley, I have to ask you to wrap up quickly.
Okay. And so with all of this, I think that the key point to remember is that email addresses are simply only that. It's an email address. Rather than a bricks and mortar address, it is an e-address. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Members, we're going to suspend this discussion. That's the procedural way I can think to describe it. It's been a good discussion, but we have other bills. What I'm going to do now is go a little bit out of order. We have another, what I would call, controversial bill. I'd like to have the authors who are waiting patiently on what I would consider non-controversial bills go next. Representative Whitfield.
Mr. Chair.
House File 621. If you can do it from there, that's fine with me. So where you are. Or if you have testifiers, I suppose it is.
Mr. Chair, so what's the proper motion to send it?
To the main
committee. Okay, so Mr. Chair, I recommend that House File 621 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. And I have a testifier here who can talk to this fairly straightforward bill, and I'm sure she'll be brief.
Rory Kropensky, please just introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Rory Kropensky with the Department of Administration. House File 621 provides classification for certain data that is maintained by a program of the Department of Administration. It's the STAR program, and it is 100% federally funded and provides direct services to individuals with disabilities and their families. We don't need any sharing of this data. Many of the people who provide very detailed information about their disability to us are used to sharing that in settings where they have the ability to protect that data. This data in our hands is presumptively public, so someone can tell us where they live, the nature of their disability, and they're used to working with the Department of Human Services or their healthcare provider or their school, locations where this data would be private. So we would like to be able to protect the identity of folks who are receiving these services while still allowing transparency as to the nature of the kinds of services we provide. And it is limited to five of these services: device loans and demonstrations and alternative financing. So it's as tight as we could make it, and it doesn't include some of the public awareness or listservs and various other things that we would have. It's just the elements that are the direct service we provide to individuals in Minnesota with disabilities and their families.
Thank you. Any members have any questions, concerns, comments? Anyone else wish to be heard on this bill? If not,
Mr. Chair, so I will renew the motion that House File 621 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Okay. All in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you.
Chair.
The next bill we'll take up is Representative Earhart's bill. You've been waiting patiently. House File 798. Welcome, Representative Earhart. And I'll move the bill. I'll move that House File 798 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Never having been in this community before, I'm enthralled by opportunity.
It's mutual, Representative.
Go ahead, to your bill.
Okay, this bill is concerning the knowledge base user fee and construction manager and general contractor that was involved in the knowledge base user fee study. It was in December 2010. At the direction of the legislature, the MnDOT mileage base user fee pilot program began. There were 600 volunteers. The Renton County and Winnipeg County had GPS units installed in their cars. I was one of them. The GPS units passed vehicle trip data from the vehicle to MnDOT. MnDOT received the information about the overall vehicle trip duration, time of being passed along. MnDOT at that time received a temporary data classification from the Department of Administration to classify the names of participants' contact information, data contained in the application for participation in the project, data contained in application for the purchase, lease, or rental of the GPS navigation device, participants' vehicle identification, financial and credit data, and participants' road use data. Temporary classification expires on August 1st, 2013, at which time the data becomes public. This is the effort to cover and classify the data. I have a witness from the...
Sir, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Zuniga. I am an attorney with the Office of Chief Counsel, and I am the acting data practices compliance official. As Representative Earhart has stated, in 2007, the legislature appropriated $5 million to MnDOT to conduct a study. Prior to beginning the study and installing GPS devices, we did receive a temporary classification from the Department of Administration. That temporary classification does expire August 1st of this year, unless the legislature permanently classifies that information as not public. What the legislation also proposes is that MnDOT is allowed to produce summary reports on the study detailing road usage and types of vehicle use, as long as participants' identities are not ascertainable. What the legislation also does is it provides some guidance to MnDOT if we ever have to produce the data to law enforcement agencies, which says that only under a probable cause search warrant are we to produce the information.
Thank you. Any members have any questions, concerns, or comments on this bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll wait till after the testifiers.
Okay. Anyone else? Thank you, Mr. Zuniga. Anyone else here wishing to be heard on the bill in the audience? Mr. Neumeister. Just reintroduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'd like to see following the bill. First of all, as already said, Mr. Chairman, this is a $5 million bonding bill program. This is a bonding bill several years ago. $5 million has been spent. I don't know if it's still continuing or not, but the bottom line is after $5 million has been spent by the government on a program, I would like to at least, I think it would be in the public interest to have at least the names of the participants and participants' contact information. This is a unique type program, which is being looked in the future, doing revenue raising for our highways. And I think it's important to at least get some kind of feedback from the people, particularly with the kinds of things that are very near and dear in regards to privacy, of how they felt about the machines in there, the kind of information they got, and some of the feedback. So if there is going to be a proposal to continue the temporary classification, I'd at least take a look at some discussion about the names of the participants and the participants' contact information be somehow public, so the public themselves, you know, people who are interested can ask them questions, or at least leave some possibilities of opt-in, opt-out, or whatever. I think public accountability
and transparency. It's very strongly favorable.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Very much into Section 2. This is what I call a Byzantine approach to data practices. Some data is public at one time, some is private, and it becomes public or private. The bottom line here, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to get basically on the record, after this process, what would be no longer available to the public as it relates to the construction manager, general contractor data. Again, that's a very important information to have for accountability and transparency. So, Mr. Chairman, if that can be, what is eventually left the public?
Mr. Neumeister, is that a rhetorical question, or do you want
Mr. Chairman? Well, Mr. Chairman, that is a rhetorical question, hopefully, that someone might pick up because it's confusing for me and whether or not you so desire to ask the testifiers who are in support of this, we can share that on the record. It's up to you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Mr. Zinnelli, can you quickly answer that question?
Yes.
Emphasis on quickly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, once a contract is fully executed, all data about the process will be public.
Okay. Thank you. President Holbrook, are there any other testifiers in the audience who wish to be heard on this bill? Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walsh, Chair Simon, he was speaking about the Section 2 of the bill that everything would become public at the end of the program. Is that correct?
Mr. Zinnelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, yes, that is correct.
Representative Holbrook.
First of all, it's unusual that we would not have this go to policy first to see if they think your construction manager thing is good policy. So are you going there next with this bill, or?
Oh. Maybe that's a question for Representative Earhart. Could you talk about the path of the bill?
I am not aware of anything except that this item is included in the Omnibus Transportation Policy Bill in the 2012 session, but was removed from the bill because staff believed it was included in Omnibus Staff Practices Policy Bill, and it was not. So it already made the circuit once.
Thank you, Representative Holbrook. I'm told that it probably will have to go to Transportation Policy.
And Mr. Chair and Chair Earhart, are you speaking of the entire bill or is just one of the sections?
Representative Earhart.
I'm speaking of House File 798 language, as far as I know.
Mr. Chair,
all of it. Mr. Zuniga.
The actual contracting authority did pass last legislative session, so MnDOT does already have the contracting authority. Right now it is a pilot program, so the authority is limited to 10 projects, and the number of projects cannot exceed 4 projects in a calendar year. So MnDOT already does have the contracting authority. This is just the data practices provisions that were left out of last year's legislation.
Mr. Chair, relative to Section 2, I'm just going to... First of all, the issue on Section 1 has been around and rejected over and over again, and it illustrates the problem with these temporary classifications. We now, basically, with the testimony in front of us, we now have Round 2 of we get authorization to do something, but we haven't taken care of the data components of the program, and now we're going to circle back around and try and get, so I suppose if you don't get Section 2 of your bill passed today or this session, then you'll go to IPAD for another temporary classification and come back in 2 years to try and resolve. I mean, this just is not the way to do business, and I don't like being put in this situation. We now have, after the fact, we've been conducting this program, collecting all this data on individuals. They have no guarantee of anything but a public classification when the temporary classification runs out, and they don't seem to even care about that. I mean, we just go forward with the program, and I'm here, we sit as policymakers, knowing that MnDOT has gone ahead, collected all of the sensitive information, you know, and we don't really have any good choices. And I mean, I don't know how to fix it exactly, but the fact that, I mean, the irony of it to me today is that there's two sections in the bill. The first one we've been over and over and over many times as being problematic and bad way to do business, and now section two of the bill tells me, oh, we got authorized through another program last year, didn't take care of the data stuff, and we're back again to start the whole cycle on another program at MnDOT. And I mean, I don't know how to fix it, but I'm reticent to support voting for the bill because it's just bad way to do things.
And Representative Holberg, I get your point. You know, it is what it is in terms of the data that's already been collected. There probably isn't, if from your standpoint, an easy way out. Maybe that's the subject of another bill to make sure there are better guardrails when this thing happens, which it sounds like it will, again and again and again. So that's a separate issue, and part of it's bound up in transportation policy, which is why I'm reluctant to get into that today about the very wisdom of doing this next project or any project anyway. So I'm not sure what to make of that other than, well, are there any other members that have comments or questions on this bill? President Scott?
Let me put an explanation point on.
Sure.
I'm certainly hoping we don't have a temporary classifications on license plate reader bills coming out in 2 weeks. Just an editorial comment.
Of course. Representative Scott.
I was just going to say, it's one of those, it seems like a case of it's easier to ask for an apology than it is for permission. And why is it difficult to ask for permission when you're, before you collect this data, why can't you come to us and ask for the permission prior to the project being lifted off the ground?
Mr. Zanino, quickly.
Sure. Representative Scott. The language as it regards to Section 2, it was in last year's legislation, and it's my understanding there was confusion at the conference committee in the transportation policy, and someone actually believed it was in the omnibus data practices bill, and it wasn't, so it was taken out of the policy bill. I think it's also important to note that as it regards to the construction manager, general contractor, we actually haven't even started any projects yet. The program is still being developed. So we actually have not collected any data related to the construction manager, general contractor program yet.
Mr. Chair, if I might, just for clarification purposes, the reason it was taken out of the transportation policy bill is it had no place in the transportation policy bill. It had not been discussed in data practices. It's another incident where you have Chapter 13 running around in omnibus bills at the end of session doing weird things. And so, yes, it was yanked out of the transportation policy omnibus bill, but it had not been addressed in data practices.
Okay. Any other testifiers in the audience who wish to be heard? Representative Portman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just can't let this bill pass by without saying that these data issues are just one reason that I think mileage-based user fees are not a direction we should go in transportation finance in the future.
Okay. Members, I think we are going to have to take a vote on this. We have other bills. So I'll remove the motion then. House File 798 be recommended to pass and refer to the Maine Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Please oppose, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Earhart. We'll then go on to Representative Lesch, the chair of the full committee, if you're ready, Representative. And hopefully we can try a lightning round here if it's not a controversial bill. Yeah, Representative Lesch, you can stay at the table if you will. Representative Garcia is here. I'll move Representative Lesch's bill, House File. I'll move that House File 828 be recommended to pass and refer to the main committee, to the Civil Law Committee. I see that there is an amendment, the DE1 amendment, just to get it in the shape that Representative Lesch would wish. I'll move the DE1 amendment. All in favor of the DE1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
So now this bill is in the shape that Representative Lesh wishes it, which is a DE1 amendment. Any opening comments, Representative Lesh?
None. I'd ask Ms. Engler to take it away.
Ms. Engler, just introduce yourself, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Katie Engler. I'm with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I'm going to be speaking to the DE1 that you just adopted. Section 1 is a very technical change that recognizes that fingerprints really are no longer captured on paper, but rather are sent to the Bureau electronically. And the language that's here is in part a provision that says that when an individual meets certain criteria, they are eligible to have their record of the Bureau destroyed. It's very difficult to return an electronic records to someone, so we're asking that the language be changed to that we destroy the electronic fingerprint record. Section 2 is the first of a few sections that relate to the language that governs our secure communications network. The first, Section 2, recognizes that changes in technology mean that we are no longer necessarily moving data using cables and optic fiber and are going to clouds and other places. And so we're trying to basically freshen the technological references. Section 3 modifies a definition of what is a criminal justice agency to include federal government agencies like the Federal Bureau of Investigation or the Drug Enforcement Agency, both who operate from offices within the state of Minnesota. We also have a few agencies that operate just across our borders but serve people in Minnesota. And so we want to have them be able to have access to our secure network. Section 4 makes some minor changes that keep this language defining non-criminal justice agency parallel with the previous section. I will note that we will only serve non-criminal justice agencies within the state of Minnesota. Section 5 basically describes what you can use the secure network for. The first change on line 3.15 updates statutory reference from the public law citation to the United States Code reference. The change in line 3.7 narrows the definition of an emergency for when people can be on the network. Clause 8, which begins on line 3.17, discusses the fact that there have been some instances where you as the legislature have authorized agencies to have access to data that is available through the Bureau, but you have not authorized them to be on the secure network. The idea is that if you give them authority to get access to the repositories, this language would say you're also giving them permission to be on the network so that they can actually get the data in the easiest possible way. Clause 9, beginning on line 3.20, would authorize the court to have use of the network for purposes other than criminal justice. They do occasionally look up things related to other pending matters before them that come from repositories that the Bureau maintains. The next changes begin in line 3.30. I went back and looked because Representative Lesh had asked me why it said adjacent state. It comes from 1965 when they were setting up teletype communications. And so basically the changes here
about teletype and
smoke signals.
And so the language recognizes that we now have an organization that is made up of all 50 states that allows for the secure movement of data among the states and into Canada and Mexico for certain purposes. And so this just cleans up the fact that we're no longer in the teletype world. Beginning with line 3.33, we're codifying the standards that we use to have agencies connect to the secure network, including things like agreements for contracts and to follow policies, to pay required fees, and to conduct fingerprint-based checks for people to be on these networks and have access to this data. Paragraph F, beginning in line 4.11, talks about those non-criminal justice agencies that get either data from a criminal justice agency or directly because they have a connection and are going to use this data in order to conduct some sort of evaluation of an individual, should themselves be evaluated to see if they should have access to the data.
And then paragraph G describes the process to be used in conducting those background checks and making those determinations. Section 6, that begins at the bottom of page 4, is a codification of a process currently in place by using ordinances to allow local units of government to use the Minnesota Criminal History Repository for background checks. Part of what we've experienced is that not every agency has been defining things in the same way we would like to see them do. They also suffer the expense of publishing an ordinance once they've adopted it. And by putting this in statute, everyone would have the same standards that they would use to use this connection through the secure network and have access to the criminal history repository for either evaluating applicants for employment or for volunteers or applicants for licensure at the local level. Section 7 and 8 relate to firefighter background checks. And if you look at the language in Section 8, it talks about the superintendent creating a plan for these background checks to be conducted. What we're doing is codifying the plan that has been in place for several years. It's a combination of both state mandated check and the option for a federal check, or a federal check when someone has lived in Minnesota for fewer than 5 years. And it again sets out the process that we must follow. When the FBI gives access for civil purposes like employment, they have certain criteria that we have to meet, and then we have to submit the statute for approval by the U.S. Attorney General before the checks can begin. And so that language is reflected in Section 8. Section 9 relates to issuances of permits for explosives. We've had language in statute that tells us who's disqualified, but we haven't had language that says do a background check to figure out if they are disqualified. So again, we're creating the language beginning in line 7.23 to do that check. Shifting to Section 10, this is related to wholesale liquor licenses issued by the Commissioner of Public Safety. Again, we're setting out the process to use to conduct the background checks. We've known what is disqualifying, but we haven't had explicit authority to conduct the checks. There's a similar language in Section 11, which is for retail liquor licenses, which can be issued at the city, county, or state level. And the last section is a repealer. The McGruff Safe House program no longer exists on a national level. Section 299A.28 requires a background check from the McGruff House of volunteers, and since the program doesn't exist anymore, rather than clean up the statute, we thought we ought to repeal.
Xander, is that McGruff the crime dog? Is that what you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is the crime dog is still there.
Oh, okay.
The safe house program isn't there anymore, where children can go, where the picture is in the window if they don't feel safe.
That's a vestige of my and other people's childhood, so take a bite out of crime. That's right. Okay, any comments from committee members on Yeah, Representative Holder.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, now I'm kind of sad because that's always one of my examples of how horrible our background checks laws are. The McGruff House has just said do a background check. It didn't say who, how, why, what, or anything. So
you support the repealer?
I think I do, but I am just curious on page 8, section 10, line 8.8. How do you determine whether a person is of good moral character and repute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I did not think to ask the Alcohol, Gambling, and Enforcement Division how they make that decision. They do that on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety.
Is there, Mr. Cheese, is there a box you check on the background check? Or?
Is that what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I have to find out.
I know that that is not, does not pertain directly to data practices, so I don't know that I have to go down that road, but interesting question. Any other member comments on this bill? Anyone in the audience who wishes, I want to say needs, but I'll be nice. Anyone who merely wishes, Representative Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, some people may say, I just raise a point. This is on 1.245, the word destroy. If it's not electronic,
I still believe that people should be able to have their prints or whatever. I mean, it's been a practice where you go, you ask, they'll give them to you. And there still might be some print out there, I don't know. But people would like to have that data. Rather than destroy and take that away from having that record.
Fair enough. Any other comments? Any other testifiers who wish to be heard on this bill? Seeing none, any other member comments, questions, concerns? Okay. Seeing none, then... it was my motion. Yeah, I'll remove my motion that House File 828 be recommended to pass and refer back to the full committee on civil law. In favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Members, we will now go with Representative Allen's bill. And again, just the method to the madness here is the last bill is obviously a little more controversial. We're unlikely to get it done today, I'm sorry to say, but rather than strand one member here until Friday, I'd rather do it strand one member and not a handful of members. So, Representative Allen, I'll move that House File 837 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Allen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm going to go through my understanding of this bill here, and then Ms. Lee will talk about, give us some examples of what she believes that the issue is, the problem that we're trying to address here. So this deals with basically two types of entities. Well, one is there's the Home Ownership Center, which receives funding from the federal government through HUD and the NHFA through the state funding for housing related services, home ownership services to be specific, education, counseling, training, and they'll be testifying so they can talk about what they do. Grant recipients, the Home Ownership Center determines the eligibility for those funds, for those federal and state funds. So for example, the Rouse Assistance Center is a recipient. We use them as an example here. So they receive client data from those that they serve. And then that data, the Home Ownership Center does help them with their data reporting requirements under their grant agreements. That data is provided to Home Ownership Center, and then at some point that information will also be reported by the Home Ownership Center to the federal government and to the state of the NHFA. I'm sorry, I drew a picture here, but that is clear. That's where we're starting from here. So really we're talking about what happens to that data and when after it leaves the Laos Assistance Center and then goes to the Home Ownership Center. And we know that there are certain requirements under state and federal law, and it's my understanding that, that the client should know that they sign a waiver, that they understand that information is going to be provided to the Home Ownership Center and then ultimately whatever funding agency. So that should be clear to them. But there appears to be a problem with how the data that the Home Ownership Center collects is used, and there's this concern or question as to whether it's used for other purposes other than to report to the funding agencies, the HUD and the NHFA. I want to make it clear that we're not accusing the Home Ownership Center of any wrongdoing or violating any laws but it's simply that the clients that the Laos Assistance Center serve, there is a perception and trust issues with when they give their data, that at some point they're concerned about how that data is used.
And so I think it's about, it's really here about whether, you know, we have transparency here and how that data is used, and then also that we, if we, if there's some way that we can address so that there's an understanding of how that data is going to be used. And I'll have Ms. Lee give some examples. Before we do that, I want to, the provision that is problematic is the last sentence. I've talked to the opponents, those opponents to this last sentence, and the homeownership center does not have a problem with A, with paragraph A or B, the first sentence. That's how they treat information under their current policies, that they treat it as, but there is nothing in the law that requires that. So they don't have a problem with that. It's the last one is what we're trying to get at, the use of that, and their concern is, and they can speak to that, but is that is going to interfere with their ability to fulfill their reporting requirements under federal and state law. So we want to make sure that we don't interfere with that. So I'm going to ask Ms. Lee to give some examples of the use of that data that they're concerned about.
Before you do that, I just want to figure out kind of where we are here. We have a few minutes left. Obviously, we're going to go a little bit over, but I know there are members that absolutely positively need to leave here by 5:45 because of the meeting, DFL members. And so, and my intention, Representative Meyer, out of respect for your bill and the, no doubt, you know, lengthy testimony, it was not to keep you here, it's just that we want to get some of these other bills out of the way, but I understand there may be people on your, could anyone raise their hand if they're here on Representative Meyer's bill and absolutely positively cannot be here on Friday? Okay. If that's the case, then I would, out of respect for you, Representative Myra, you've sat around here for an hour and a half, and I'm sorry about that, but I think it's probably best to just let you know we won't get to your bill. I would take it up for the benefit of those who absolutely can't be here on Friday, but then this will be the last bill. That said, on this bill, Ms. Lee, you're supportive of the bill? Or you have issues or problems?
No, I was giving testimony.
In support?
In support of the bill.
Sure, yeah. And who is here who has problems with the bill? Just raise your hand. I need to know your names. Anyone? Okay. So, Ms. Lee, if you can be brief and just give the examples, and I don't think you need to repeat what's in the bill. Ms. Lee, if you introduce yourself for the record, and then we'll get to the opponent, and then we will take a vote, and that'll be it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, RR Family Centers, which does shelters and transitional housing, and have the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium, which covers over 20 service provider agencies as far as being culturally specific. Our concern is that the client data that we collect as counselors deserve the same level of data privacy as attorney-client privilege and doctor-client privileges. The clients that give us the information trust us, and they actually provide us more information than they would give to an attorney or a doctor. And this is very comprehensive data because we're into holistic services, and we have to really understand the clients and their issues. And so this data we keep on agency forms, and we also, for the HUD-approved agencies, they're required to put it on HUD forms. Our concern is that the forms that are being given to the grantees, as far as a requirement, if you receive funds from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, are put on home ownership centers forms and not government form. And according to an email who questioned that, they say they will co-own the data as if they were a nonprofit agency. Well, they are a nonprofit agency, just like ours, but then they own our client data.
Right.
And so this creates a level of distrust among our clients as far as us being able to work with them. We have found where our clients have been solicited by the Home Ownership Center for services other than, you know, you talk about and provide, and they're wondering, you know, it's created some problems. And I also think that because we deal with the shelters where we have victim witness protection programs. And when you deal with the vulnerable, we deal with people who speak limited English and seniors, that we have a certain level of client confidentiality must keep and we maintain. So we have Ralph Assistant Center, who's supposed to be here, has said that they will provide data required by HUD, but that's the limit. They won't give data on clients beyond that. And we have had, like I say, other incidences where the data has been misused, and also incidences as far as the other things they use to the data to compete in funds where the grantees are trying to get funds directly from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency or the federal government. So that, in brief, are some of the issues.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Thanks for the brevity. I know that we have another testifier. If you come up, introduce yourself for the record, and if you could be as brief as you can.
Mr. Chair, my name is Katie Topinka. I'm with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And just want to clarify a couple things. First of all, we're not necessarily opposed to the bill and opposed to the data becoming private. As Representative Allen mentioned, we have some concerns with the last sentence in the bill. And just to clarify the structure, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency receives state and federal funds and then allocates those through a competitive application process to nonprofit counseling agencies. The Minnesota Homeownership Center, who unfortunately isn't here today, but they have a contract with the agency to do the reporting, which is required for the federal funds and for the state funds. And so our concern, particularly with the last sentence, is that if the agency or subcontractors may not own the private data or require the grant recipient to disclose that data, we may not be able to comply with our federal reporting requirements. We are required to give information such as name, addresses, and other information. Anybody who receives the counseling does sign a release that they're understanding where the data is going. Also, you know, we're not aware of any instances of the Homeownership Center soliciting clients for other services, and we have received information from them that's not a practice that they do. But again, we're from the agency, just wanting to clarify how this would impact our ability to report on that.
Thank you, Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really want to agree that I think there are some issues with this, and I've read through this a couple times. It sounds kind of like it's a turf issue to some degree. My concern is that if, and I'm sorry that the Homeownership Association isn't here, but I can't figure out why this isn't covered by current law. If you are contracting with the Ownership Association as your agents, they're required to adhere to Chapter 13 and only disclose information as permitted by that contract. And so if in fact the Homeownership Association has been alleged here is using this data for other purposes, my guess is that it's already against the law. And so I'm not clearly understanding what we're trying to accomplish here, other than maybe muddying some waters. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong.
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Holbert, that is correct that they, you know, do fall under Chapter 13 as a contract with the agency. Housing Finance Agency does have a couple places in Chapter 13 that are specific to the agency. So, you know, name and address are public, but financial data is private under Chapter 13. And anyone who receives a grant from the agency is, so an individual, that's also private. And so you are correct that it does fall under Chapter 13.
Representative Holbert? Well, Mr. Chair, again, I'm sorry that this intermediary group isn't here to speak for themselves. I don't know if they can come back on Friday, but we don't need to clutter up the statutes with unclear language. If they're already covered under current law, we should just figure out what the problem is.
You raise a fair point, and I don't know, Ms. Lee, to that specific point.
Mr. Chair, to that point, I have some documents as far as emails where we question the use of the data, and the homeownership center said by using the client, putting the client data on their form, they thereby co-own the data and have control over the data as if they were their own agency. So that's what we object to, is their ownership of the data. It has nothing to do with, and so by that, they have bypassed the law regarding client confidentiality or whatever that we as the provider adhere to with their own trust issues. And so it's their way of getting past the law. And Mr. Chair,
Representative Allen.
I believe that the only thing that this would cover that's not currently covered under current law, not protected, would be the names and the addresses. That would be the only thing.
Representative Oliver, you still have a concern about whether we're being redundant here. Are you saying that? Okay, I mean, is the idea that? I'll just ask it. I won't. So, when you got this email saying we co-own the data, you know, they may make that claim, but I think like what? Stop me if I'm putting words in your mouth. I think what Representative Holbrook may be thinking is they're just wrong. They may have claimed that to you, but they may not be right. Current law may mean they're wrong. If I understand your position, Representative Holbrook.
Well, like I said, unfortunately, the organization's not here. What I'm hearing from the Housing Finance Agency is that they're the intermediary, record keeping, et cetera, but I don't think they have any more powers than the Housing Finance Agency has, because only by virtue of a contract can you, you know, impart your powers to somebody else. So, I mean, we're not a court. We're not going to settle it. I don't think we're going to settle this in 5 minutes and sort it out. And I don't think we do good data practices and we just rush through.
Yes. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Representative Holbrook. I think we should hang on to this and spend a little more time looking at it on Friday. On the basis of what I've heard now, wouldn't vote in favor of the bill. And I'm not sure that we need it. And I don't like the phrase at line 1.12, but information may be determined or prior. I mean, it's just I think we've got some issues we have to discuss with the bill, okay. And we should do it on Friday.
I think that's right. And Ms. Lee, I know you and I spoke before this bill was even dropped in about this and the situation you described with the email, but it could just be that they were wrong or that we already have safeguards in place that neither they knew about or maybe even you knew about. Chapter 13 is pretty thick, so I think we should lend this over. It is. It's tough to navigate. So we will lend it over, and we can talk about logistics as to Friday, but thanks, members. We'll be back on Friday at 11:30, and the meeting is adjourned.